This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. We are back again. I am Rob Polder, the Coach Development Officer. With me, we have barbecue queen extraordinaire, Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me. Not sure about queen, but getting there.
Well, look, my arteries are hardening as I talk. And we have the man that has been cutting his own hair for, you know, how long are we up to now, Coops?
Yeah, well over a decade.
Well over a decade. Think of the money saved. Welcome, Coops, to the podcast.
It's good to see you, guys. Thanks for having me.
You can go to Coops for all your self-styling tips in lockdown. I know people are struggling without hairdressers and the like. We appreciate, as always, all the likes, shares, the retweets, all those kinds of things, the ratings and reviews on the podcast. Please keep those up if you are able to. It's we're slowly hedging towards potential reopening, which would be fantastic on our end, and being able to get kids back on the court. And obviously, the country areas of the sport will be open before the metro areas. So trying to work out a little bit, we're talking confidence today more than anything else. So what we're looking at is how to get it, what happens if you don't have it, all those kinds of things around not only our players, but also us as coaches as well. Because one thing that we probably did notice when we came back last time was we heard a lot of player X has lost confidence. They're not confident in what they do. They haven't played in so long, these kinds of things. What did you sort of find, Coops, when you came back for the first time with kids on court? Like, did you notice that waver a little bit?
Yeah, we had, it stems so much from our game, you know what I mean, that it's decision-making based. And even with, you know, a pretty good skill base, if the decision-making is taken away from you for so long, and all of a sudden you're in that incredibly intense and vibrant environment of a, you know, of a basketball practice or a game, you know, it's going to take time to come back, and you know, you have a few poor decisions, and then they build, and then, you know, that leads to poor performance, and poor performance starts to shatter confidence. So it's definitely something that's coming off what everyone's experiencing. So really good time for this podcast.
Yep. What did you sort of notice, Zoe, when you jumped back on court with the kids?
Mostly really high anxiety, like, and it came from, I believe, low confidence, because it was, I'm so excited to be back, but I don't want to make an error because I want this to be fun. And, you know, it's that running in quicksand type thing, like the harder you run, the more you sink and all that sort of stuff. So I saw a lot of that. And so we had to take a lot of time. A lot of coaches, I believe, we're all in the same boat, to really recreate that environment where, hey, we want you to make errors here. We want you to try things. It's okay. This is actually the fun part. And then when we took away the stigma that comes with making errors, then anxiety reduced, confidence came back, and it wasn't perfect and it didn't happen with every athlete, but it was as best as we could get, I suppose, in the short amount of time we got to be on the floor.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things too where it's really easy to just knock confidence away. It's just it's just something that happens. Mm. And it's there, but, you know, it's not really a massive priority for us. But the confidence will waver of players in particular. Like, they can have a 20-point game one week, then they can, you know, not hit water if they fail out of a boat the next week. Like, it's that sort of thing. Like, it does go up and down with swings and roundabouts, and shooters in particular. Like, we talk about shooters' confidence in especially. Vital they have that. But we've got to be really careful too that a lack of confidence doesn't turn into that performance anxiety that you're talking about, where they get really antsy and nervous before every game. And that can be, I mean, there's good nervousness and there's bad nervousness, of course. But what I did notice with a lot of the athletes that I worked with that were just coming back, super high confidence as soon as they stepped on the floor, because they were excited to be there. Mm. So they had this really high opinion of themselves, and probably a little bit of an unfair opinion of themselves in a few cases, but that's a different problem altogether. But they were really confident when they got there, but then when the gameplay started, the interaction started, those kinds of things, that's when the confidence wavered, because what they remembered pre-COVID is not what was being produced post-COVID.
Yeah. I think one of the problems with that that comes with that, I can't remember what it was. I need to get like Coops level remembering people's names and where I find this information, like the reference king, Nathan Cooper Brown. But I remember hearing somewhere that with our brains, you know, you have that sort of a performance. Let's say it's at Diamond Valley, because that's the closest to our house. So you have a poor performance on court one. So the next time, it could be 6, 8, 10 weeks later, it could be a year later, you walk into that stadium, your brain will automatically scan for danger and I guess memories of, you know, hurt or think, you know, because we're constantly fight or flight, you know, fighting these sort of fight or flight urges and as instinctually, you know, scanning for danger. That's what we do as animals, I guess. But whether it consciously comes into your brain or not, already you've put yourself into a mindset of I'm going to have a bad game tonight, or last time I was here, you know, it was awful, or whatever it might be. And that's already, you know, seeping into your mindset and how you approach games and you know, how ultimately you end up performing. And so that's the sort of thing we need to try and, I guess, as coaches, recognize and intervene and be able to allow athletes to understand that bad games happen, especially when we first come back, and try and break that, I guess, flight, you know, that fear of, oh, well, and I remember doing it as an athlete. Kilsyth Stadium for a long time for me was like, I may as well have not turned up. Like I was so bad every time I played there because I had one bad game there, and then it was, oh, I remember last time. So, yeah, I think it's to help with that confidence. I think as coaches we need to try and, I suppose, recognize as best we can that when these things are starting to creep into our athletes' minds and intervene, that's when we need to try and don't interfere but intervene.
Yep. That was David Stiff that spoke about it at the Basketball Australia Coaches Conference.
There you go.
You know, not all of us can remember names, Coops, but those of us that can, very helpful to have. Yeah. And he spoke about it as well. It wasn't just necessarily the playing side of things, but it was also injury. And I know we were working with an athlete. We walked into Lauren Jackson Stadium up in Albury, and the first words out of one of the players' mouth was, "This is the court I did my ACL on." And it's like, okay, so what sort of mindset are you in walking into this thing? Like, all you're thinking about is, last time I was here, I remember going off on a stretcher, took me 12 months worth of rehab, didn't get to play after that. So immediately you know that mindset of that athlete is not necessarily on what's going to happen in the game. It's just, I just want to get through this and not do an ACL.
And as a result, the way we coached her that game was different to how we normally coach her. Short, sharp bursts, just especially early, just get through them. You know, so you get through that little 2-3 minute patch and, hey, got through it. We're good. You know, and slowly, slowly we could extend it out. Where normally that athlete would probably not be in the rotation, like not be coming out and into rotations until late in the first, if not midway through the second. But this was different. We had to get this athlete through the game, and it's all about their mindset and that fear affects confidence. And I think especially when you're starting to worry about injury, I'm using a lot of analogies here. It's like the, you know, when you're carrying when you're little and you're carrying like a hot cup of tea or something, and you're watching it and you're watching it and you're watching it because you don't want to spill it, and then you stub your toe and you spill it. Like it's that sort of thing. If I focus so much on it, it's probably going to happen. So trying to just alleviate that fear and that anxiety, and it's not easy, and I don't think there's one quick fix, but yeah, I think recognition, if you can recognize and intervene, you're halfway there.
Yeah, and you don't want to speak it into reality.
Yeah.
Like that's it's the self-doubt and the self-talk and all those kinds of things that really matter. Like, Coops, what are some of the things that you've noticed with players lacking confidence? Like, what sort of things do they do? What sort of things do they say that all of a sudden spark you to say, hey, something's not right here, I need to intervene?
Yeah, physically, hesitancy is a really big warning sign, especially if it's in an area where you've seen them be maybe more courageous or have more success, and then all of a sudden now they're not willing to take the game on or attack the rim or be more of a, you know, touch distance in your face defender, whatever it may be. So that's a good physical trait to kind of keep an eye out for. When you're talking about maybe mentally or through communication, you know, some players that are really self-aware can have a bit more of a conversation with you, or, you know, you may actually hear them say, hey, look, I'm down today, or I'm not feeling it, or, you know, my shot's not there. And obviously that's an easier one because it's a little bit more black and white. But then also if you're looking around too of maybe, you know, players starting to remove themselves as well. So go out on floor, we're in a drill or an activity, make a couple of stakes, miss a couple of shots. And then normally, you know, that's that same player who's willing to take the next one, all of a sudden moves themselves to the back of the line. It's okay, all right, yeah, there's something else going on here that maybe we need to address. So probably just three or four things there that coaches can keep an eye on.
Yep, and as we know, shooters shoot. And all of a sudden the kid that does not let that thing fly when they're open, they're looking for, you know, they've already got from good to great and that's their shot, and there they're looking from great to greater. It's like, yeah, but that one's probably not there. Like that's the one that usually gets taken away. So those kinds of things in games as well really make a difference. And because we haven't played for so long, who knows really what that looks like? Like nothing makes a shooter feel better than seeing the ball go through the net. So if they're not prepared to shoot it, how are they going to get any better at it? How are they going to build confidence? And there's lots of different things. Like we just don't want to pigeonhole shooters as you're a shooter and that's all you do. Doesn't mean you don't get to defend down the other end, because we certainly have some responsibilities on that end of the ball as well. But it's those kinds of things. How would you deal with an athlete that, I mean, you spoke about it before, the athletes that are aware that will come and talk to you about it and say, look, I'm not feeling it today and those kinds of things. How would you deal with an athlete that probably isn't aware that they're lacking confidence at that point, but you can tell, like they've maybe tucked their shot away or they're a little withdrawn from the group? How would you deal with that?
Yeah, if we're talking kind of short term, maybe in a game, I think it's similar to what you guys were talking about with the athlete that you know, that did their ACL. It's kind of refocusing the mind back on the positives. So thinking about some things they do well and that they can tap into in the moment. So we're in a game, let's say a game we're using the example of a shooter, they're not making shots, but I know that that player is a great rebounder. You know, it's like, okay, you know, let's shift the mindset away from the shot and let's get into the area of the rebounding. Hey, you know, you've got a great matchup right now. I've seen you, you know, have 10 boards or 5 offensive rebounds in one game. You know, next time you're out on the floor, you know, let's go get 2 0 boards. Go do something that you do really well. And of course, if we can reduce that goal or that expectation. So I wouldn't say, hey, go get 10 rebounds, because, you know, hey, how about in the next 2 minutes, you go get us an O board? You know, we really need an extra possession right now. So that's a small, achievable goal that taps into a strength. And then very quickly, what you'll find, and the sports psychology backs it up, is that, you know, just achieving that one goal, having that little bit of success, can really start to spark positivity and, yeah, especially in other areas as well. The other one that I've used in the past that I also heard from a sports psych that I found really beneficial is helping to shift the athlete's mind from them to us, from the I to the we. And that, okay, you're going to sit down here or wherever the situation is, and I want you to really invest in the success of others. With the research saying that, you know, I'm watching Rob, and Rob goes and does something great, something we've asked him to do, dives on a loose ball, whatever it may be, and you really get into it. You know, you're clapping it up, you know, and all of a sudden your whole mindset shifts. I've gone from an internal negative place to an external positive place, and I'm clapping and I'm into, and all, I've completely lost, and you know, that place, that bad place I was in, and now I'm back into more of a positive mindset, and then you're almost pushing the reset button. So I think there's value in that as well.
I've got a question. Mm-hmm. I'll put it to you first, Rob. What level or what part of confidence do you believe is on the athlete themselves?
Yeah, okay, well that's loaded. So a lot of it, no question. Like if you've done the work, you'll feel confident. Like it's, you know, if you're playing against a team that you know traditionally zones and you haven't got your shots up during the week, well, you're not going to feel real confident on the perimeter. Like if you're playing against a big that changes shots and you haven't worked on any adaptive finishing, well, you're not going to feel confident. So there is a responsibility on the athlete that they have to do the work in that space to feel confident. It's like a math test. If you haven't studied, well, how do you think that test is going to go? Fairly poorly. And speaking from experience, it goes fairly poorly when you don't study for math tests. But there is a responsibility, I believe, on the coaches to identify players that are potentially struggling and try and pump up the tires as best you can. Now, if you're dealing with an under-10s team that potentially loses games by 40 points, well, they're going to feel pretty rubbish anyway. So you have to try and find some achievable goals, similar to what Coos was talking about there, like maybe not go out and get 10 boards, but maybe it's a case of, look, let's see if we can just complete 5 passes. And from there, then we can look to try and shoot or whatever the case may be. But it's that ability to refocus the goals, I think, as a coach. And you are, as a coach, a storyteller. You get to shift the narrative to wherever you want it to be. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Sometimes you almost have to make up something that's a bit fictitious to say, yeah, I love that box out. And they're like, damn, I didn't even realize I boxed out. No, but you didn't even realize how good that box out was. That's how good it was. You can just shift them a little bit just to make sure they're okay. Now, you don't want to let them just get away with murder, of course. Like, as a coach, you do have to be mindful that you still need to be able to hold people accountable. But you get to tell the story and you get to let them know what can be celebrated, what can't necessarily be celebrated, what we need to refocus on. Like, the worst thing I think you could do is walk up to an athlete and say, look, I think you're struggling. Because what does that athlete do then? Like, oh, damn, I didn't even realise. Like,
I thought I was doing all right.
Yeah, I thought I was going okay. And all of a sudden the coach is walking up and saying, so it almost, again, it becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy where now they have in their head, well, damn, the coach thinks I'm struggling. They have no confidence in me. Now I'm starting to doubt everything where actually I was in a pretty good space before. I was just trying to do something I maybe wasn't capable of doing or didn't want to do at that point. So it's a balancing act between the two. I don't think there's necessarily a one or the other. And, you know, this is the whole it depends answer. But, you know, that's okay because it is. It's a two-way street. Mm. And to be honest, the people that will notice the lack of confidence first, I actually think is the parent. Like, they're usually the first ones to say they're lacking confidence. And sometimes it's the coach's fault. Sometimes it's the player's fault. Sometimes it's just mythical and it doesn't actually exist in the first place. But
sometimes it's the car ride home.
That certainly plays a part. There's no question. I'd love to say it doesn't, but it absolutely plays a part where you have to be really conscious that it's a bit of a team effort there. Like, you know, like what Coots was saying before about shifting the focus to, like, and I've certainly done it with what I'd nicely call bench players that I've had in teams in the past where, you know, you see a lot of NBA teams turn themselves into like a terror squad or a bench mob and things like that where it's like, look, we know we're not the starters and that's okay, but I need to have a role that I can play in this team. And, you know, traditionally they've been the players that are maybe not necessarily as talented but are super dedicated, really committed to it. It's like, well, look, you guys can go and cause a little bit of grief for the opposition because you're going to be our run and jump team or you're going to be our pressing team or you're going to be our high energy type team so that when they're all in together, they have a role they can play into. It doesn't necessarily see the scoreboard rattle up, but it also doesn't see you go the other way where you start losing as well. So I think finding a role that everyone can play is really important. It doesn't mean that role has to stay the same every week, but there is a lot to be said for if you can achieve success in something, that is infectious, I feel like. And that will then flow on to the next person, the next person, the next person, and all of a sudden you've got a really cool team environment where they want to do things for each other as well, which, you know, as we've all experienced, is hard. Like, that's not easy to achieve.
Yeah, so. Well, and mid-game, I think coaches can play a part with rotations, and it's not easy, not in any way saying that it's easy, but if, let's say it's your 10th athlete, you know, the one that probably plays the least amount of minutes, but turns up to everything, works their butt off, you know, does everything, great teammate, all that sort of stuff, but all of a sudden they're lacking some confidence and they're, you know, feeling a bit down about themselves. If you rotate them in with 6, 7, 8, and 9 versus the other team's starters, well, we're not setting that athlete up to regain their confidence and to get that success. Whereas if we've got them with, you know, 4 starters plus the 10th, now there's an opportunity for some success. And like you said, that becomes infectious. You see the other athletes when someone's struggling and they turn that corner and something works, you see the team just rally behind them and, you know, it takes them to that next level. You start to see them smile. You start to see them find the joy in the game again, all that sort of stuff. So I think little things like that we can be mindful of as coaches. You know, more often than not, we probably skate through with a similar subbing pattern, you know, sort of unless there's foul issues or whatever that might be. But it's something to I think, keep in mind if you do see that athlete struggling, especially if they're at the back end of your of your rotations.
Yeah. I think building on that too, because I think there was a whole theme there about basically putting players in a position to succeed, that you can think about it from a system standpoint as well. In you've got a last 8 second philosophy around, we're going to play middle ball screen last 8 seconds, but you bring your backup point guard on who's not great in the ball screen and maybe is going through a bit of a rough patch with it too. So confidence is down, especially in that area. So easy coaching adjustment. Okay, when we're in last 8 seconds with player X, we're just going to spread it out. You know, we're not going to bring the ball screen. We're going to let him play with his strengths of, you know, ability to create a split or whatever it may be. You know, and then he builds confidence through that. And then you can address the ball screen stuff, you know, maybe a practice or through some film or whatever it may be. And I think that's an important area for coaches to contribute to it.
Yeah, and we've all seen the backup point guard is usually the one that gets pressed. Like it's very rare that you it's very rare you go after the starting point guard because they're usually fairly capable. They see that thing all the time. They're used to it. But we all know coaches will go and get after the backup point guard. So similar to what you were saying, Zoe, like making sure that there's at least a bailout there for them, like whether that be your better trail big that can handle the ball a little bit, plays behind it so that they know that, look, worst case scenario, if I get trapped, I can at least reverse it and we can go play from that point as well. So making sure you do have a contingency in place, like what would you do against yourself in that same situation? If I would press that point guard, there's a reasonable chance the other coach will be pressing that point guard. So it happens a fair bit, I think. And, you know, we've all been at those tournaments where you probably don't need to be a genius to work out who the shooter is on the other team because they let that thing fly on the three-point line and all five kids on the bench stand up and they're, you know, anticipating that thing going on, then it rattles out. And you see it all week and you look at their numbers at the end of the week and they're like, you know, 2 of 28. But every time they shoot the ball, that whole bench is up and they all think it's going in. And it's like, well, if it's good enough for them to think it's going in, there's no reason that the shooter should doubt that it's going in as well. And we've all seen players go through funks where they just, you know, can't hit anything. But it's keeping that confidence to be able to go and perform. And I think the talk around the athlete really matters a lot in that. So both from the coach and from the teammates.
Was that a lesson you learned at Ulverston?
It was. It was.
Tell the story. Yeah. Story Look, time.
I don't know. What's the it's that one, I believe. Yeah. So had the pleasure of coaching an under-16 Nationals down in Ulverston in Tasmania, and there was an athlete there that we knew was a shooter. Like, in fairness, like we knew going into that tournament the kid could shoot it. The numbers told a different story, it'd be fair to say, during the course of that week, where we made some decisions. We got to him in the final. We played him in the round games and dealt with him fairly comfortably. Like, we just had a night out, a morning out. I think it was like a 9 a.m. game, freezing cold. We're playing Queensland North. And they were not enjoying life coming from the sunny 22 to 28 degree life.
You guys ran out with no warm-up tops on.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, -5 degrees, that's what we're about. Like, no problems at all. Like, we had a fairly easy time of it in the pool games, but we certainly got to the final and it was a different world altogether. As we all know, finals are a very different space. So we had a scout on the kid and it's like, well, look, this kid can shoot it but hasn't shot it well to this point. So here are our rules. We will adjust if we need to adjust and do what we need to do. And of course, the kid who has, you know, barely made anything all week has a night out on us and we come home with a silver medal instead of a gold one. But I mean, that's the confidence of that kid. And look, if you talk to that kid, like, does not lack in confidence, it'd be fair to say, but that's what he was. Like, he had no fear shooting that shot because that was his shot. He knows he shot that shot a ton of times, would do anything to stick it to us, which, you know, credit to him as well. And, you know, has gone on to be an NCAA champion.
Yeah, like, well, but that's a credit, I think, to the coaching staff, but also the other athletes on the team.
Yep.
They had no issue finding him on the three-point line, and as soon as he caught it, they were rebounding.
Yep.
So it was like, no, you're shooting it. And even after having had a below-normal performance week, it was still find him, and, you know, and get up after the glass. So yep. I think, you know, the coaching staff for creating that environment and then the athletes for following through on it and then also obviously the kid to be able to stick the shots big time after, you know, games they'd won by 30 during the week, not being able to find the bottom of the net. And then when it matters, you know, and it mattered even more because I think it was like a 1 point game in the end, 1 or 2 point win.
Yeah, no, this is really good. Really good.
So, yeah, sorry. But it wasn't like they were up 30 and now he starts, you know, sticking threes. The game was clutch from the tip to the Sirens. So, yeah, I just think that's a really good example, as much as it probably sucks for you to have to relive it, a really good example of maintaining a confidence in an athlete when you know they have a skill set and that you can go to it and it can be an advantage.
Yeah, really big chance this gets edited out. We'll see how it goes, though, over the course. I appreciate that. So we talk about athletes struggling and being down on confidence. Is it ever good for an athlete to struggle? Like, is that something that you kind of feel like they need to work through and everyone needs to go through it? Like, if you never face any adversity, like, you know, have you ever really achieved anything?
Yeah, I think they do need to struggle a little bit because if if any of the country women are listening to this, they're going to say, oh, I've heard this before. I believe your development happens outside of your comfort zone. So if you stay within your comfort zone, you'll only ever be that good. And I think to be able to develop, to be able to go to the next level, to make you good, great, and you're great elite, you have to be challenging these athletes to do things that they're not good at and that they're not comfortable with. As well as it learns that resilience. You know, our game at the end of the day is nasty. Like, I don't know many athletes that are going to go through and say, yeah, I had a winning record. You know, like more often than not, you're going to probably lose more than you win, or, you know, it's not all going to be smooth sailing. So all athletes, I think, need to go through a little bit of that. And that's when, as coaches too, we get to see who really wants it, who wants to become a better athlete, who wants to go to the next level. And not everybody wants to, and that's fine. But I suppose from our role, like Coops and myself and Jenny and Darren, our role is to find those kids. So we have to hope that, you know, our VJBL coaches and then our Hub League coaches, when we select the kids and are pushing them outside of that comfort zone so we can see, do they want to bounce back or do they want to walk away?
How much does your reaction to that matter, Coops?
I was just going to say one of my favorite quotes is the comfort zone is a beautiful place, but nothing ever grows there. I'm sure a few coaches have heard that one before. So I think that's apt, and everything that Zoe was just saying is right on point. And the only way that I can add to that, I think, which kind of ties into what you're talking about, Rob, is that you can still show success and you can still have a positive aspect in the struggle. So, you know, there's an end point that we're striving for and we're struggling to get to, and we're throwing different things at you and the resilience is being built and all those sorts of things. But along the way, we're having success. We're ticking some boxes. We're doing some things that shows we're on the right path and that we're moving forward. And this comfort zone is not this horrible place, you know, where the coach is just yelling at you and down on you and you hate basketball because, you know, you're not having the success that you want. It's the push. It's taking you to the next level. So, the reaction of the coach will be very much based around where you're at in that process. They've experienced some success. Cool. Okay. Now we've got to move the goalposts and find that next level of discomfort. Or we've had, you know, 2 weeks of discomfort and you can see the shoulders starting to slump. It's like, okay, let's find some ways to have some success today and build it back up a little bit as we go along this journey.
Yeah, really important. And it is one of those things where everyone will be a little bit different and depends on the age group you're dealing with and all those kinds of things as well. One of the best things I think you can do is kind of laugh about a mistake and just go, okay, that was dumb or stupid or just poorly executed. That's fine. We'll have a laugh about that, but then we'll move on from it. Like, we acknowledge what's going on. We make it so that they're not fearful of making that mistake again. Okay, I'm not going to yell at you for that mistake and I'm not going to just scream at you till I'm blue in the face. That doesn't really make anyone feel any better. But what you can do is have a little bit of a laugh about it, acknowledge it, tell the athlete, hey, it's okay. Like, we've seen this mistake being made by hundreds of athletes before you. You're just another one along the line. And then give a little bit of advice or feedback. And it's like, well, okay, We laughed about it. We've acknowledged what's going on. We've recognized it. We've had a quick chat about it. Here's what you can do to make sure this doesn't happen again. And I think that's sort of a reaction where they now feel comfortable to make additional mistakes is really important. We don't want them fearful of making mistakes, because now we have training sessions with zero intensity, zero tempo, zero push to go hard enough. Whereas if you can make it an environment where you're happy for them to make mistakes, their confidence doesn't waver as much. All of a sudden, they're like, well, actually, I want to try that again. I want to see if I can do that better, or I want to see if I can do something that nobody else has done before. So the reaction from the coach is actually really important in that space. We talk about the fixed mindset and the growth mindset. We have to live in that growth mindset. And if we don't, we're just going to produce cookie-cutter players and coaches.
How do you manage, you know, we've all had teams where there's that one athlete that sets very high standards and, you know, is a super competitive beast and all those sort of things, but their reactions can affect the confidence of other athletes. You know, like an athlete tries to make a pass and it's turned over or it goes out of bounds, and that athlete that is your, maybe your leader, it is maybe your best player on the team, whatever it might be, but that competitive, you know, high standard athlete slumps their shoulders, maybe swears, drops their head. How do you manage that?
Yeah, that's bloody hard. No. That's not easy. Like that's, but this is a lot of stuff that you would hope that you would do at the start of a season with setting like a leadership group or some standards. Like I don't know, it's a little bit of splitting hairs, but I don't like rules personally. Like I like standards. Like here are the standards of our group. This is what we're trying to do. This is how we're trying to uphold it. We don't want to let our standards slip, so to speak. So I'm really big on standards over rules. And if you can get those set up in the first part of the season, that's a huge thing. What was really interesting, and we've probably all watched it over the course of the last week, was watching the Opals play in Jordan. And we had an athlete there. I mean, it was a young group. There's no question. Like that was a really young team that went away. Sammy Wickham, obviously super experienced, like elite shooter, WNBA athlete, phenomenal. But that's someone that hadn't been around that group at all, like has come in late, is probably disappointed she missed an Olympic squad, has come into a World Cup qualifier, and you wouldn't have known any different. Like, she held everyone accountable. Like, there were times she took the time out, like she had no problems just jumping in and saying, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. She had no problems grabbing one of the bigs by the singlet and saying, you need to be doing this, and if you don't, there are going to be repercussions. And some of those athletes dealt with it really well. And in fact, I don't think I saw anyone bite back at her over the course of that as well. So when you look at it, it's like, well, that's someone that obviously has high standards for herself, high standards for everyone else around her, and was respected. So as long as you have an environment there where you give the players a voice, but you may need to come in and say, hey, maybe a little bit too far on this one. But as long as you have an environment where that works, I think it's more powerful than a coach having to hold people accountable.
Yeah. Well, that Wickham example, though, whilst I remember an incident in particular where she was sort of she wasn't berating a player, but she was definitely giving firm instruction. But as soon as that athlete did what she was asking, she was the first one there. She was the first one high-fiving, getting excited, or up off the bench.
And it didn't work on the first
instance. No, it didn't. Like, but she was still, and about.
Yeah, she really encouraged, like telling an athlete, you got to roll on the rim. And threw the pass and they rolled. Probably wasn't the best decision at the time, but had to show that reward for doing what they were told at the same time, and was up and about and was into them and, hey, great job. And so next time, well, now you know you're going to get the same reaction.
Yeah. I think, it's kind of come up now a few times about creating this environment, creating an environment of confidence in the athletes, creating an environment of, faith, not fear around mistakes, and creating this environment where players can hold each other accountable the right way. And, when you're talking about confidence, something I use with my athletes quite a bit is preparation breeds confidence. And if you're talking about it from a coach's perspective, well, you can start establishing this environment, before a ball is bounced. We're talking about culture, letting your players know this is the environment that we want. And then obviously you modeling the behavior and your athletes modeling the behavior creates the culture and obviously environment going forward. But I think, you can spend time, in your preseason and prior is getting this message out, letting the players know this is what we're trying to do. This is how we're going to support you. This is how we know is best practice, and then go and model that behavior. because it's just going to lead to you know, the best environment possible. But also, you know, players don't like surprises. Players like consistency. Players want to know, you know, what's my role? How do I fit with the group? Where is the group going? And then they can kind of sort themselves out a little bit within that. And then, you know, that's going to help with the confidence, rather than we're three games in and then, oh, you know, I'm now expected to do what, or you're challenging me on what, like, where did that come from? And that mixed message can really hurt a player's confidence.
Yeah. I think the key word that you mentioned is consistency. That consistency is really important in our behavior as coaches. So if we're going to say that a particular behavior is unacceptable 1 week for a certain athlete, then that behavior is unacceptable for all athletes every week. It doesn't, you know, the best player on your team doesn't get away with poor behavior because they're the best player. On the other side of that, you know, the 10th player on your team gets the same amount of energy and the same amount of, you know, excitement and reinforcement as your best players. And that I think helps with confidence as well, especially for the athletes. If they can, it's the Tim Duncan sort of thing, you know, Pop treated him exactly the same as everybody else. And that's massive because he's one of the greatest players to ever play. But, you know, if he stepped out of line, which in fairness, he rarely did, but if he stepped out of line, he copped the same response and the same reaction as a kid that's just come up from G League. I think that's something we need to keep in mind as coaches, and we sometimes forget.
Yep. And you can do things to help with confidence and the team buy into. Like, you can manipulate drills at your training session where it's like, look, I know how I have an elite passer that cannot score to save their life. So we're going to weight this 3-on-2 drill so that assists are worth 4, you know, made buckets are worth 1. And you can sort of get them a win along the way where they don't even realize they're getting a win. And so you can do things like you just shift the goalposts a little bit. And whilst some may suggest it's not fair, it is fair because you're trying to get the best out of the athletes in that situation. Like, Coops, you're the most cerebral, next level, on a different worldly plane person I know. How are things like breathing, visualization, imagery, and those kinds of things, how can they be used for the athletes?
Yeah, look, I'm a big believer in them, both from personal level as a coach, but also having seen experience with athletes. And I think there's room within all those things to find how they can work for you. So you may not, you know, choose all of them and or attack them in a certain way. I've had some discussions with some athletes recently around. One just didn't really like meditation and that side of things. But I suggested a book called A Still Quiet Place for Athletes, which is a great kind of work-along workbook, which allowed him to write some things down and just kind of monitor his progress, which he's found really, really helpful. So, I highly recommend both athletes and coaches looking into those areas. And you'll find what works for you, because there really is a great combination of those things that can be beneficial. And kind of coming back to what we were talking about earlier, I was listening to a psychologist this morning, you know, and we're talking, this is exactly what we were saying earlier, but about, you know, that your brain is a map of the past, and you wake up and 90% of your thoughts are from yesterday. And, you know, if yesterday was a rough day, you know, the likelihood of you kind of building on that and having a rough day today is pretty high. So using reset words, using your mindfulness ability to catch your train of thought and be more of a creator of your future rather than a monitor of your past can be such a huge stepping stone in again, having control of your mind and building towards confident and unknown excitement in performance, rather than that, you know, oh, I had a bad game here, or today was a rough day, or I'm focusing on whatever negative thing, you know, impacted me that day. So, you know, again, we always throw our contact stuff out, but if people want to discuss it further or want some resources, I'm always happy to throw some things at them.
That sounds great. With player routines, like, how big are you on player routines before the game?
I'm probably a bad one to ask because I had them as a player. And I think they are important as long as they're controllable. So, for instance, listening to certain having to listen to certain songs before a game is not controllable. You know, your phone might die or, you know, that might not be played at the place you're warming up or whatever it might be, you know. Shooting certain shots before a game is not controllable. You know, you might turn up late because of traffic. You might not have the same amount of warm-up you normally get or whatever it might be. But, you know, so as an example, my routine, I always had to tape my ankles because they were hideous. And so it was – and I couldn't play without it. So regardless of if I was late, I had to tape my ankles. So it was tape my right ankle, put my right sock on, put my right shoe on, tape left ankle, left sock, left shoe, and then I was ready. Like it was almost like as soon as that left foot hit the ground, it was like, okay, here we go. And I've noticed I still put my shoes and socks on the same way now. Irrelevant information, but I do think it's important to have something to sort of say, okay, this is separating me from, you know, normal hanging out with mates, seeing people I like, being at a basketball court, to, okay, now I'm ready to play. But I think the controllable part is key. You know, I have to have my shoes and socks on. I had to tape my ankles, you know, but, you know, there's so many things that I think athletes need, and if they can't get it, then it just throws them off completely.
Yeah, that's such a great point. It just, yeah, controlling the controllable and not setting yourself up to have a poor performance because of exactly one of those things was taken away from your routine. But I was listening, I think I was listening to another podcast where they were talking about how the routine, you know, a lot of players kind of think of it around superstition, but the idea that it actually is just allowing you to take your mind off whatever's happened to you potentially that day or even the performance and just kind of pull yourself into the moment. Yeah. So it's a little bit of a mindfulness trick to have that same routine to just kind of bring you to where your feet are and then go from there. So I'm with you. I think, yeah, that it's a smart one. I think the other part of that too is understanding your optimal level of arousal. Story time, Rob. When I was growing up and playing, like the whole thing was everybody, it was all hip hop. It was all rah, rah, rah. And you had to get jacked before the game and, you know, hip and shoulder everybody and pumping music and all this sort of stuff. And I found, especially when I got to college, by the time I got on the floor, I was wrecked. I'd spent so much time, you know, in warm-up, exuding all this energy that by the time I got on the floor, I was gone. So I started meditating and listening to calming music. And I would still have a detailed warm-up, but it wouldn't be as kind of ferocious, and found that that just gave me that little bit of extra energy that I needed, you know, once the ball went up or I got subbed on, that really contributed to me feeling that much better on the court. And so just, again, an understanding of who you are, how your routine affects you, what's your optimal level of arousal and how are you in control of it and not letting the elements control it, so to speak.
And you have a little bit of a switch, I find. Like I look at kids walking on Friday nights and they all do the same thing. They're on their phone, their head's down, they're not paying attention to anything that's going on before them. And there's actually a really important part of that they should be allowed to do. They should be allowed to come in, hang with friends. Like there's a massive social aspect that goes with this, no question at all. But there has to also be a point where it's like, okay, now I'm done. Like I'm away with it. Like I was reading about a boxer the other day that it is one of the loosest people that you'll ever meet. Like it's just crazy, does all this sort of weird stuff. But they reckon from the second he gets his hands taped before a boxing match, different person altogether. So from that point to the end of the match, completely different level. And that's something we probably have to be a little bit mindful of with our kids too. There has to be a switch off point where what is normally going on in my life, which is the social side of things, goes away and now I'm focused in on the game and then I can flick back. And the ability to almost flick a switch between the two is really important. And trying to find a way to not be so super aroused all the time like you were, Coops, but also get to a point where it's like, okay, shelve that for a bit. Now I have to be focused in on what I need to focus in on.
Yeah, and I think it's important as coaches too, we need to recognise who needs what. So I've got a story time. It's a trifecta.
Good Lord. You guys are heaps better at this than Ash ever was. Ash would get halfway through the story and go, where was my music? Not like it's.
So when I was playing for Bullying Boomers in the WNBL, a dear friend that I played with for a lot of years, Desi Globitz, she liked to be by herself in warm-up. Like she'd get there, you know, an hour before. We had to get there an hour before, and she got there an hour before that, so she could get, you know, shots up and just sort of be by herself, and she liked to stay quiet and all those sort of things. I, on the other hand, I like to laugh. I like to sort of not muck around. So when we're in warm-up though, like we had to warm up, but, you know, if I saw something funny, I'd laugh, or I'd say something stupid and laugh, you know. So, and that was the way I think of getting out my nervous energy, you know, and getting myself prepared and ready. So as a result, and because we were seniors, it was easy for me to recognize what Desi needed, and what she didn't need was me. So I'd stay away from Desi. Don't get me wrong, I love her to bits, but I would stay away from her because I would be detrimental to her mindset before the game, and kind of vice versa, because when you're talking to somebody and they give you nothing, it's kind of, and now I start thinking about, why isn't she talking to me, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I think it's really important to recognize who needs what. There might be an athlete that does need to go and sit by themselves, you know, a couple minutes before the game starts, and that's okay. Like, it's not, they're not being antisocial. They're not, that just might be what they need to, you know, like what you're saying, Coops, to not make sure that they maintain the amount of energy that they need for the game. And, you know, it'd be really big, I believe, in introverts, because being around a lot of people all the time really drains them of their energy. So they might need a second, you know, to sort of go away and sit and regroup and gather. You know, your extroverts might want to sort of chat, and of course we don't want them to muck around and do things they shouldn't be doing. But I think that's where we need to get to know our athletes, because some people might have looked at the way I behaved in warm-up and go, does she even care that she's here? But you couldn't, if you had said, Zoe, you've got to leave, I'd have taken down anyone that tried to make that happen. I wanted to be there. I was ready. But that's just that sort of getting that nervous energy out is what I needed to be the best version of myself once the game started. So understanding your athletes and understanding what they need, and then allowing them to do it. You know, it's really, you see a lot of coaches like, all together, we've all got to stay together, we've all got to stay together. And you've got your poor introverts going, I hate this, you know, like I just need to recharge before the game starts, you know. So yeah, I think that's something we could probably all learn from. I suppose we've got off topic a little bit from confidence, but I suppose if we're setting them up for success, yeah, it'll help their confidence.
Yeah, I think it all breeds into the same thing. Speaking of confidence though, Coops, how do you is it possible for a start, but how do you also deal with an athlete that has too much confidence?
It doesn't exist in Coop's world.
Yeah, I've systematically been working for years now to make sure that that doesn't happen by just beating it out of players, but they still keep popping up every now and then. I think establishing roles is a big part of that, because you don't want to extinguish the confidence. You just want to redirect the confidence to the areas that we want it. And so, yeah, they may think that they're the best passer, but they might be a better shooter. And so we could talk about role that, you know, in this situation, we'd prefer to have you off the ball, you know, so we can utilize your shooting skills. And, you know, not saying that you're, you know, a bad passer or whatever it may be. We're just saying your playing role, this is where we want you. And so we know that that player is going to have that confidence in that area. So I think that's a really good place to start. I know we haven't spoken about it yet, but it's almost crazy that we haven't, but film is a big one, you know, that we can use film to reaffirm the areas that, you know, that they are really confident. Hey, you know, fantastic job on, you know, your rotations here, again, whatever may be the area. But then we can also use our film to talk about maybe some of those areas that they're confident in, but still need work, and therefore just, obviously the film doesn't lie. Hey, here's some areas that we can improve. Love that you're confident in you're doing this or throwing that adaptive pass. Hasn't come off the last few times. Let's go away and work on it, so we can build it into your game. So just a couple of strategies there I think could help coaches.
How did – I don't know if both of you have. Have both of you coached DJ Vasiljevic before?
Same staff.
How did
you – Tamworth.
Okay, yeah. So talk to me about how you dealt with that. I watch him in just absolute awe. I love the way he's just, the confidence in his ability. I don't know that there's ever been a game, they could throw him in the NBA right now and he'd be like, yeah, I'm one of the best shooters here. Like, and I just, like, it's so rare, especially from Australians, to be honest. But I love it. Like, I think it's really cool. But it'd also have times where it was testing, I think, as a coach. So what did you guys find, I suppose, being involved with such a confident – obviously you had the skill to back it up, but such a confident athlete?
Tough one. Like, it's we never doubted his ability to make shots. Like, that was one thing. Like, we had that confidence in him, there's no question. We used to do a thing after every game where the players would rank themselves out of 10 as to where they thought they were at, and then we would, rank ourselves out of 10. And I know that tournament in Tamworth, like, we were probably a little down on him early. That, we didn't think he was probably playing as well as he could have. And he consistently ranked himself higher than us. Like, yeah. No question. Like, he was always like 3 or 4 points above where we had him at. And look, to his credit, like, end of the week, like, when it came time to play, like, I remember his final, he was next level. Like, yeah. And like, we were having the joke about it, I think, in like our last pool games. It's like, he's ranking himself like eights, nines, and tens, and we have him as like threes and fours. Like, man, if this kid goes off, like, what's he going to give himself out of 10? Like, 25? Like, it's, he was that sort of a kid, but he was just super cool. And look, he did the work. There's no question. Like, he was a diligent, hard worker. Like, he was another of the Nick Abdusevich school of individuals and the like. It was crazy how good he was in that space as well. So it's, I didn't have any doubt with him. Every now and again, you may need to pull him back to earth because the shot selection maybe wasn't exactly the one you wanted, but geez, it was a lot of fun too.
Yeah, I mean, awesome kid to be around, and it's still great connecting with him now because he's still the same guy, which is awesome. One of the best parts about coaching, and I totally agree with Rob. It's just, it was really funny just watching him. But in kind of, it's almost in contrary to that, but it's still the same thing. Finding with him. And I know I've spoken a lot about this on the pod because it's a value of mine, but awareness. And he, even at that young age, had great self-awareness, especially around what he did well. So that he was still, even if he wasn't playing as well as he could, he wasn't going outside of what we needed him to do to get himself going. You know, he understood that he was a shooter and a defender and all these little things that made him a good player. It wasn't like all of a sudden he was running to get the ball and trying to be the point guard or anything like that. So as much as we found like, okay, he's a little bit out of whack in where it is, it's like he knew who he was. And so the confidence was there and we knew that it was going to click at some point and obviously it did. And he's kept that. Like, he knows who he is as a player. He knows what he does well and he works on it. And then the confidence just aligns with it. So I think if players can continue to understand who they are and what they do, they're going to help themselves in that space.
Well, how do you go? You mentioned, sometimes you had to bring him back to earth a little bit. Shot selection gets, away sometimes.
A couple of car park shots.
Yeah. There. But how do you go bringing an athlete like that, bringing their feet back on the ground a little bit when – they're a shooter and you want to instill that confidence and you want to keep that confidence, but also knowing that that could be the very shot he will win you the game with, in 39 minutes time. How do you navigate that?
I don't think it's a good way. Like, you need to reinforce that, okay, let's think about where we're getting our shots from, what sort of a shot we're looking for, knowing full well that he is more than capable of sticking a one-footed jumper falling out of court. Like, and he will shoot that because there were times I know when it was late clock where it would be just find DJ. Like, it didn't matter because we knew, one, he didn't care about his stats to the point where he didn't want to be that person with 2 seconds on the clock throwing to the next person and say, it's your problem. Like, he was always happy to shoot that shot. That was never an issue at all. But it was still finding shots that he wanted to take was the big thing. And, you know, we had to be really conscious. I know we spoke about it a lot on the bench, Coops. Like, we just need to run something for DJ to get a clean look here, because if we don't, he's going to kick something up that we don't want him to kick up, and it's going to be out of, like, way out of left field. So trying to find a way, I think, within your rules to keep everyone on the same page is really important.
Yeah, definitely. And then it comes back to that environment too of, and obviously easier the higher that you go, but if you can lean on your athletes a little bit to have that same mindset and understand, again, know your teammates, know the situation. If we got a really good point guard who's got great awareness, okay, we need a three. DJ's our best shooter. He loves it from that spot, and that player can go ahead and run it or take care of it without it necessarily coming from the bench. Well, isn't that what we've been talking about for a long time and trying to make ourselves redundant and create that sort of team atmosphere that could do exactly the same thing that Rob's talking about.
So we've gone roughly 55-ish minutes here and haven't spoken about coaching confidence. What can coaches do to build their own confidence?
Do the work. That's all. Like, it's unfortunately, I know I sound preachy and probably a bit nasty, but, experience breeds confidence in coaching, and you have to make mistakes and you have to reflect on them, learn from them, and then try to avoid them. Surround yourself with people who will tell you what you need to hear as opposed to what you want to hear. And when they're telling you that, please don't be a yeah, but coach. Just take it and again, reflect on it. You don't always have to agree with it, but I think there's nothing more you can do than do the work and surround you with people that you know care about you and tell you what you need to hear. Like, I know in my journey early, I was very low on confidence because I didn't think, I was coaching under 12 bottom age teams, so 10-year-olds, and I think they're in regional something, and I was still really anxious that I didn't have the ability to coach because I'd never coached before as a head coach, and so I was sort of like, oh my God, I'm going to embarrass myself. I'm not going to do the right thing by the kids, all that sort of stuff. And then as I started to get a little bit more successful, I'll be honest, I started to believe in my own hype a little bit, and I got away from myself. And then the man sitting next to me promptly grabbed me by the ankles and threw me back down to earth and said, you still need to work on A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. And I'm like, holy crap, the whole alphabet. But it's what I needed. So I needed to hear that. And so then you need to find the balance as a coach of confidence in your ability. You need to be able to walk into games, walk into practice and be like, I've got this. Because if you walk in sort of nervous or anxious, the players will sense that, and depending on the age group, either take advantage of it or absorb it, and then that becomes detrimental to the session as well, or the game, as well as knowing that there's always more you can do, more you can learn, you can always be better, all those sort of things. So yeah, the only real advice I could give would be, do a long-winded way of saying, do the work and surround yourself with people that will give you honest feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You have to do the work. Coaching so much lends itself to experience, and you don't get it without going out there and treading the boards. I think the reflection piece is a really big one. I know you said that word a few times there, Zoe, that I don't think our coaches do enough of, is take the time either, to kind of talk a little bit Mark Bennett, hot review, cold review, take those moments to go back, have a think. I know we've all talked, but you guys heavily, Rob, I know about, wearing a microphone, like microphone or a camera or whatever it may be to invest in your coaching. And take the time to break it down. But then in that reflection, I've used this strategy with players in the past, and it's been really helpful, is a positivity journal. And I'll just put a pin in that. But the reason I talk about that is within your reflection, like if you have been in an environment where you've had a tough day or a loss, it's okay in your reflection to still come back to some positives. Yeah, okay, we lost the game, but this ATO worked really well. Or, you know, I had a great exchange with this player. So as much as we're doing the work, we're in our own growth mindset, you can still, you know, if you're going to be your biggest critic, you can still be your biggest fan and find ways in building confidence in yourself and finding things that you did well. Just to come back to the positivity journal for those that may be interested, it's a way of just helping, again, shift that mindset. Similar to what Zoe was talking about earlier, you know, we've got this prehistoric mind that's, you know, in kind of fight or flight, avoid the danger. And if there's a player or a coach that is struggling, after every basketball session, game, whatever it may be, they have to have a journal or a workbook, and they need to write down 21 things that they did well. And 21 things is a lot. And especially if you have a tough day, it's really hard to find. Now, the kind of the rules of the positivity journal, it can be any. It could be like, I did my shoes up really well today. So, you know, you do have to kind of really dive deep to find them. And you do that for, you try and do it for about 30 days. And in going through that experience, you're actually shifting your mind to look for the negative, the potential ways of getting hurt, to the positive and the things I'm doing well, and having a bit more of an enjoyable, you know, kind of frame of mind in how you're doing things. So I think the reflection part is something that we can all do a little bit better job in.
Yep. And I mean, the questions you want to sort of ask around that, what, how, if, yeah, why, can, those types of things, more the open-ended type things that'll make you really reflect on it well. And that's how you can coach as well with your athletes. You know, when you're working on shot technique, how did that feel? You know, what could you do differently if we shifted this, or could you do this? Those kinds of things as well. So it's really important as to how you package that as well, for not only for yourself but for the athletes too, I think is really valuable. That wraps us up. We are done. Thank you everyone for jumping into the podcast. Greatly appreciated. Coaches, thank you for jumping in. We will catch everybody on the podcast next week. Thanks everyone. Look, tune in and join the tribe on iTunes and Spotify.